Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For years, our big habits as a nation were the engine that drove the global economy, consuming more than making, borrowing more than saving, and Americans importing more than exporting. Well, the new world order, economists say, is going to force some new habits on us. They're talking about America, exporter to the world. That was once us. It may have to be again. But how and exporting what? This hour, On Point, the call for an American export surge, what that would look like, what it will require. In his State of the Union speech in January, President Obama said exports will be key to the future of the American economy and laid out an ambitious goal.
We need to export more of our goods. Because the more products we make and sell to other countries, the more jobs we support right here in America. So tonight, we set a new goal. We will double our exports over the next 5 years, an increase that will support 2 million jobs in America.
Sounds like a heck of a goal. Joining me now from Washington is Greg Ipp, U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist magazine. He wrote The Economist's special report on the transformation of the American economy and its future as an exporting nation. On the newsstands now, Greg Ipp, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Can it be done? Can we double exports in 5 years?
I think 5 years is a bit of a stretch, Tom, but I think that might miss the main point of what the president is trying to drive at. We don't need to literally double exports. We just need exports to grow more rapidly than they traditionally have and to grow more rapidly than imports. Now, what we've seen over the last few years is a little bit of that, but in a slightly different way. We've seen exports and imports both fall because of the global recession, but imports have fallen more quickly, partly because our exporting markets like China, India, and Latin America have held up reasonably well during this recession. And as a consequence, the trade deficit relative to the size of the American economy has actually fallen by about half, from around 6% of gross domestic product to 3% of gross domestic product. And in the last 3 to 9 months, we've seen exports start to recover. And this is actually a little bit unusual. Typically, when you come out of a recession, exports are one of the last sectors to recover. But in this case, they seem to be leading the recovery. And I would attribute this to two main factors. One is, again, the fact that our trading partners are relatively stronger than we are. And the other is that the United States dollar has been declining for the last 4 or 5 years, and that has brought a lot of competitiveness back to American companies.
So I can imagine a lot of our listeners, though, scratching their heads, Greg, and saying, what on earth is it that we're going to export in such volume to bring back the whole U.S. economy, to kind of lead the way to maybe double exports? I mean, it seems there are so many things we once exported and don't anymore. Now we import. What's it going to be that Americans are putting out in that volume to the world, and to what markets?
Well, I wish I knew the answer with a lot of authority and conviction, Tom, but unfortunately, it's impossible to predict now what it is that successful American companies will be making 5 to 10 years from now. Would you have guessed 10 years ago that the iPod, for example, would have been such a smash global success? But we know from looking at the literature and studies of what has done well for exports in the past is that it's probably wrong to look to the sectors where we once were strong, for example, like making furniture or making automobile parts, and think that that's what will lead us back. There will be some recovery of those what I would call commoditized export sectors, but in fact, what history and theory tells us is that most of the growth will come in those areas which are new and cutting edge, using high-value manufacturing skill and perhaps high-value services, where America tends to excel because we have such productive knowledge-based workers, people with advanced college degrees, for example. And it's hard for us to imagine what those industries are right now, but you would start with the areas where we're already doing well. And in our report, we, for example, talk about Intel, a company that exports already 80% of what it produces. And this is a company which has come out of the recession faster than most companies, partly because even during the recession, it was essentially doubling down on its significant manufacturing presence in the United States, building much more advanced manufacturing processes. And this is not your father's manufacturing plant. These are fabrication plants with $70 million machines that require people with college degrees to operate efficiently. And they're the kinds of things that Intel is only comfortable doing, principally in the United States and other advanced countries. So those are areas that will do well. Other areas that will do well will be high-value services, such as engineering or oil field drilling or even architecture, which I talk about in the special report as well. Areas that are uniquely well-qualified for Americans with, again, their very high degree of creativity and training and marketing savvy.
Okay, let me just play the skeptic here because, I mean, it would be great if this happens. Let us pray that it does. You make a compelling case that our economy needs it. But we have had a lot of these, you know, sort of uniquely American things. I mean, iPods and Starbucks and PayPal and Intel and engineering and architecture for the last 30 years. And our trade deficits have just been huge and huger. So what makes this different in the next 5 years or hey, give it 10 years? I mean, what really, really turns this around on the export front? We've had all these things and still we've been deep in the red.
I think that you should look at the trade performance of the United States in the last 10 to 20 years, not as a sign of the failure or the inability of American companies to export very well, but as a consequence of a lot of macroeconomic factors that basically worked against a successful trade performance. First of all, the United States economy for 20 to 25 years has been led by consumers. And why is that? Well, it's for a couple of reasons. First of all, there was a big rise in stock prices, then home prices. This made people feel wealthy, and so they consumed a lot. Second of all, we had financial innovation and deregulation, which enabled almost anybody to get a loan and to spend even further. And so if as a country we're all spending more than we earn, then that extra spending has to like come in the form of imports, and that creates a trade deficit. That is not so much a failure on the part of American companies to export, but a natural result of a country whose macroeconomic setup is essentially biased to over-consuming. I think those days are gone forever. Well, if not forever, for at least for a very long time. If you look at what's happened to stock prices and home prices, they're much lower than they were a few years ago. People feel less wealthy, so they'll spend less, they'll save more. And if you look at what's happened to the financial sector, it's much harder to get a loan. So as a country, it's going to be much harder to basically live beyond our means. And as a consequence, those forces will push down our consumption and therefore our imports. And American companies that want to succeed will have to look overseas because the domestic markets simply aren't there.
So China's been the huge exporter of the last 10, 20 years. They've been low wage, under consumers. Is that what the United States becomes? Low wage, don't buy stuff?
There's no question that the U.S. trade deficit is actually a two-sided story. It doesn't just reflect Americans' excess consumption and inadequate saving, but it reflects the fact that in our trading partners, there was inadequate consumption and excessive saving, if you can actually imagine that being the case. And China's a prime example of that. As you say, China recently passed Germany to become the world's biggest exporter. And China's a country that has pursued an export-driven economic strategy for a number of decades because it was the fastest way to move people out of low productivity, low income jobs on farms and in agriculture into the cities where they could manufacture for export. It was basically how did they deal with these tens of millions of people pouring into the cities every year looking for well-paying work. It's also a consequence of the lack of a safety net in China. Essentially, if you get old, then you don't have Social Security and Medicare to look after you. And so people save heavily to look after that. And finally, it's a consequence of their pursuit of an undervalued exchange rate, which again tends to drive Chinese production into exports instead of serving the domestic market. Are these things turning around? They're turning around a little bit. We saw during the recession, for example, China implemented a very aggressive fiscal stimulus in the form of additional investment spending, which boosted domestic demand. And China's imports have actually been growing very rapidly for the last few years, and their trade surplus has shrunk. And the last few days, we've heard tantalizing signs that the Chinese might be prepared to relax their grip on the currency. As you may have heard, Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, recently said he's not going to bring out a report on the scheduled date of April 15th saying whether China manipulates its currency. Why is that? It appears to be that he is some confident that they are going to make progress getting China to change this policy. And if he succeeds, then it will be a very positive signal in terms of rebalancing this dichotomy between excessive consumption in the United States and too little consumption in China.
So some structural shifts going on there. We see that. But does the United States have to become a kind of mirror of China? Low wage, under-consuming, little or no safety net, undervalued exchange rate. Do we have to ape all that to become an export powerhouse, Greg?
Not necessarily. I mean, the United States.
Not necessarily.
States, no, not necessarily. Sorry, that wasn't a ringing in.
So maybe
in,
we will.
Builder. No, not at all. I mean, we have to remember that the United States, where it succeeds, is in exporting things where there's lots of value involved. Let's look at the example of the iPod, for example. A lot of people fret over the fact that, yes, it's designed in California, but it's made in China. Doesn't that mean China gets all the jobs and the wages? Well, not really. Some scholars who actually investigated where the value is created in the iPod concluded that only about 4% of the value, 2 to 4% of the final value, came from the assembly and manufacturing in China. Most of the rest came from the components and the design and the software and the marketing. And the bulk of that occurs in the United States. So when iPods get sold in third countries, like be it Canada or Mexico or Europe, some of that benefit flows back to the people in Silicon Valley who helped design the iPod.
But who really gets the jobs, the volume of jobs? You just got half a minute before the break. But the things you're describing seem like great value producers, but not necessarily bulk job producers.
Yes, and I think that, in fact, is one of the challenges and perhaps one of the worrisome outgrowths of the trends that we're talking about here, is that the companies that export successfully in the United States tend to be the companies that are the most successful in the first place, the most productive, and they pay their workers and their executives the highest salaries. And so if we're looking at a world where most of the growth comes from those high-value industries, then it could actually result in a small number of people, whether it's at Apple or whether it's at a bank that exports financial products, doing extremely well, and the bulk of people perhaps not sharing in them. That's a big challenge.
President Obama spoke to the Export-Import Bank's annual conference last month. He said there's a great growing market in the world's developing nations, and he warned that other exporters are scrambling to get an edge in those markets and that the U.S. needs to do the same.
They're investing in the skills and education of their people. They're investing in the high-demand industries of the future. They've benefited from American consumers. They've made themselves into export-based economies and positioned themselves for the jobs of the future. They're pursuing trade agreements with growing markets. And those agreements would give their companies access to those markets and put our workers and businesses at a disadvantage. So if we stand on the sidelines while they go after those customers, we'll lose out.
The president last month on the importance of the United States pushing for exports. He's called for American exports to be doubled in 5 years. That is an ambitious goal. It may be necessary for America's economy to really get restarted in this changed world. Greg Ipp joins us today, U.S. economics editor for The Economist. The Economist magazine joins us from Washington. Also from Washington, Brad Jensen is now with us. He is at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University, a big research name in the whole world of exports. Brad Jensen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Happy to be here, Tom.
And with me in the studio, Deborah Wintz-Smith. She's president and CEO of the Council on Competitiveness, a nonprofit, nonpartisan group that brings together labor, industry, and government. Deborah Wintz-Smith, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
The president says double exports in 5 years. I can imagine a lot of Americans needing jobs and worried about the country's economy saying, that sounds great, but then wondering, how do we do that and can we do that? Is that a reasonable goal?
Well, I think it's a reasonable goal. The issue is going to be how soon do we do it. But what's exciting is we're in a great period of transformation in the global economy and here in America. You know, manufacturing and services are really merging, and we're right on the cusp of a whole revolution in how things are made and where the value comes through innovation capacity. So if you look at the global demand, particularly in the emerging world and the need for energy and better health and protein-based diets, and then urbanization, there's a tremendous new world that needs new products and services, and we're really poised to provide them through the ingenuity, innovation, and high skills of Americans.
Brad Jensen, it has been a long time, many decades, since we thought of the United States as, you know, a big export powerhouse. Not to say we don't export, we do, but when you look at the balance, it's run heavily the other way for a long, long time. Do you see a tipping point here? Is this country really situated to pull off what's being described?
I think so. I think people lose sight of the fact that we still make a lot in this country. The U.S., maybe, you know, recent data suggests that we produce as much manufacturing output as China, a country with three times the population of the United States. So people lose sight of the fact that we still make things here. You know, the things we make are not typically things that consumers buy. So a lot of it is kind of in the background.
Because it's what, infrastructure and super jetliners and I don't know.
Exactly, a lot of capital
turbines
goods.
And...
You know, the thing that, you know, what the iPod said is, it says on the back is, you know, assembled in China. As Greg pointed out, a lot of the value added is created in this country. So, you know, airplanes, capital goods, the kinds of things that are very sophisticated, that require high skill, high paid workers, are the types of things that we still produce in this country and still export.
Greg, that may be true, but an awful lot of Americans can just look over the back fence across the Rust Belt in this country and see, you know, empty factory after empty factory. It doesn't look and feel that way to an awful lot of people in many parts of the country, Greg.
And I think the sad truth is that a lot of those empty factories will remain empty for a very long time. And part of this has nothing to do with the export-import balance, but the fact that over the last 20 years is that manufacturing has actually been very successful in terms of producing more with fewer people. We simply don't need as many people to produce the same number of automobiles and aircraft and machine tools that we used to. And so even if we were to completely turn around the trade balance, then a lot of those factories would still not be needed, and a lot of those workers would not find other jobs. So I don't think that we should, as a country, spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to bring back the jobs that were lost. We need to focus more, I think, on how do we turn small companies that are all around the country with entrepreneurs who may have only got into business a few years ago and get them to make their first export sale. Because that's what we have learned from the research by people like Brad and others, is that export growth over the very long term comes from a lot of these small companies that are at first successful at home discovering markets overseas. But making that first sale overseas can be a very intimidating process. You have to learn the language. You have to find your distribution channel. You have to figure out what are the regulations in that country. That's actually an area where the government can be very helpful in terms of guiding smaller companies. And one day, those small companies will be big companies and big successful exporters.
I want to talk about the government's role in addition to everything else here. But Deborah Winsmith, is it possible that we would take on this enormous goal, double exports, maybe accomplish it, turn around the trade balance, and at the end of that, still have a huge unemployment problem? I mean, will this really bring jobs, or is this going to be a few, you know, relatively few, high-paid, high-skilled, capital-intensive goods being produced and millions of Americans saying, hey, we got the exports, but we're still out of work?
I think we have to look at the jobs in two ways. One, or what are we going to do with the workers who are, say, you know, 45 to 55 in some of these industries that have lost their competitive edge that my colleagues have alluded to? And then how are we going to really train the next generation of workers for these new skill sets? I mean, if you look at some of these very advanced manufacturing facilities in the United States, IBM has one up in Fishkill where there's not a human being in the plant making their most advanced microprocessors, but they still have the software engineers, the people that have to know how to manage this equipment. So it's a different skill set, and that's where our training comes in. The United States government, we spend over $20 billion on workforce training, but we're not training people for the jobs of the future. It's still the jobs of the past. So that's one thing we need to realign government investment on.
I want to begin to bring our listeners in here. Let's go to Michigan, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Vipul. Vipul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have actually two comments. One of the reasons that we are at such a disadvantage in terms of export is because China keeps on manipulating its currency, keeps it undervalued as compared to dollar. So my question is, why can't we do the same thing, just print more dollars, have the value of dollar go down, and that way make it expensive for them? And then it provides an incentive for the manufacturers to do the manufacturing here in the United States.
Okay, and point two?
Point two is in terms of Americans are best at innovation. So I think for increasing the exports, we need to focus heavily on our technology development, clean energy technology, things like iPod and those kind of technological advancements, and they would be a great export for us. And we need to invest in them heavily so that we can beat China, Germany, which are already ahead of us in these areas.
Vipul, let us pick those up, and let me go to tech advances first. Brad Jensen, we're constantly being told by Tom Friedman, the columnist, and others, that even in high-tech green stuff, the U.S. is way behind and falling further behind. You're presenting a picture here, as we're hearing today, of, you know, high-tech U.S. coming back in exports. But are we really lining up to do that?
I think so. I think, you know, people don't appreciate how strong, how competitive U.S. firms are, how strong and skilled U.S. workers are. You know, if we look at the service sector, and I think that there is not enough attention given in this debate to the service sector, the business services, the kinds of things that service firms provide to businesses, think software, think engineering services, R&D services, architectural services. This is a big sector. In 2007, it employed 25% of the workforce, compared to 10% of the workforce in manufacturing. In this sector, it's a high-wage sector, $56,000 per year in average earnings, compared to $46,000 in manufacturing, so much higher wages. And this sector has run a positive trade balance.
Well, let's say
so
we've
got... We can do these things. It's a big sector. People don't appreciate that there are a lot of jobs in services. And I think, you know, when we look at export participation among service firms, it still lags manufacturing. In manufacturing, maybe one in four firms exports. In services, it's only one in 20.
Deborah, maybe we've got the services here, but I want to get on the table this currency question that our caller raises. I mean, even if we've got the talent in this particular sector, and no doubt others, there's been a lot of complaining about trade policy and currency manipulation. I mean, what does the United States need from China to permit all this to happen? Can it happen if China goes on with the policies that it has had, Deborah?
Well, I don't think China can go on with the policies it's had. And one of the issues beyond the currency, and I do agree that there is going to be some movement on that, is China really has to respond to its demand. And let's just take the solar industry as an example and their energy challenges. They are making huge amount of the solar cells and panels. But now, for the first time, they're really beginning to consume some of those domestically
in China
to keep their people in jobs because of the global glut right now.
So, but is that good or bad for the U.S.? That means a huge volume maybe in China making their exports even more competitive?
Well, it means it's part of the imbalance issue, that they're going to consume more than just saving. So that, in one sense, is good. Now, we obviously want to have access to those markets, and that's where you get into the trade policy and the need, you know, for trade liberalization. But the other thing I want to say is we really need to look at this as a capital cost structure issue, and currency is one part of it. But you also have to look, you know, at the corporate tax structure in the United States, the regulatory environment. When big global enterprises decide where they're going to put their high-value operations and manufacturing, those things really play in.
You want to pollute rivers here like China does there?
Absolutely
not. Or reduce corporate taxes just when we've got a giant deficit?
Well, we have the second highest corporate tax rate, but it's really not just the taxes, but the whole regulatory environment. How long does it take to get a permit to put up a manufacturing plant? All of these things factor into the decisions.
But that may be the area where Americans don't want to copy China. I mean, go to the industrial parts of China. Some of them are awfully rugged. You don't want to recreate that. No regulations.
Well, I'm not talking about the industrial parts of the China model. I'm really talking about, you know, what does it take for us to put up the next generation battery factory in the United States that's going to be, you know, tremendously high tech. It takes siting, it takes water, all those things. We need to have a regulatory environment that is nimble and flexible while maintaining our high standards of safety and health.
We're looking at a big new export push for the United States. Greg Ipp, you're with The Economist. Your magazine is very free trade oriented. I'm looking here by comments from Robert Kuttner with The American Prospect. He's got a whole different perspective on this, and his headline earlier this year was that we're playing ourselves for fools, that U.S. trade negotiators always look for ever purer strains of free trade, but all over the rest of the world, you know, you've got governments stepping in to help their industries, not here. He says free trade itself has not worked for the United States, and we've got to be much tougher on the U.S. government sort of stepping in there and, you know, making sure that the structure of trade works for this country. You've got a free trade tilt at your magazine, but what do you say to that, Greg?
I actually have some sympathy for Kuttner's points, which is that we are sometimes naive in terms of pursuing trade agreements with trading partners who talk the talk but then don't walk the walk. And so I'm sympathetic to the Obama administration's thrust of being more vigorous and more tough-minded in terms of both enforcing the existing trade agreements and driving a hard bargain for executing new trade agreements. But at the same time, I think that if you actually examine the facts more closely, you'll find that countries that pursue more protectionist policies don't tend to benefit as a result. Let's go back, for example, to this issue of green tech. There's a lot of consternation over the fact that the Americans do not, I believe there's only one American company in the top 10 solar manufacturing companies in the world, and Spain, for example, is a leader. But Spain has poured millions and millions of dollars of public money into subsidizing that sector. I recall a study that suggested it may have cost as much as $1 million a job. That's money that has to be taxed away from other potentially beneficial industries. And if you look at somebody, for example, was talking, I think, Tom, you asked earlier, can we have... can we solve the job problem with turning the trade situation around? Well, not really, because that's really a question of getting total demand in the world up from these recession levels. I would point you to Germany, which has run trade surpluses for years and still has very high unemployment because there are so many other things that are going wrong in that economy. I think it's a much more productive thing to look at what we can do at the microeconomic level and to improve the environment for companies to redesign, to get the price signals right for them so that they know what they need to do to export more. Let's look at the energy question, for example. One of the reasons I think that the United States tends to do poorly in terms of, for example, energy efficient vehicles is that gasoline is so cheap in this country that Americans themselves tend to buy larger vehicles. So how do you change the price signals to incentivize American manufacturers to produce more efficient vehicles that they may want to buy in Japan and Europe? Well, you could make gasoline more expensive. I realize that raising the gas taxes is not exactly a ticket to being reelected, but it actually does work. It will incentivize American manufacturers and parts companies to come up with more efficient ways to propel vehicles, whether it's by electricity, by hybrid technology, whether by with better batteries or what have you.
Mm. Deborah Winsmith, we've just got you for another minute here. I want to ask the question I put to our listeners, and we've got a lot of them waiting to come in here. But you know, can this country, if we're going to push on exports, can the U.S. keep its standard of living, its wages, and be an export powerhouse? Or do we have to get sort of down there in the wage tier of China and the rest of the world, the emerging economies, to do it?
I think we can. And I'd like to make the point, Tom, that we're talking about manufacturing in a kind of a 20th century way. Manufacturing, the higher value manufacturing, has really merged with services. And we have to look at this from the ideas, the research and development, the design, how things will be made at the nano level using modeling and simulation, logistics supply chains, all of that as part of this extended manufacturing enterprise. And we have tremendous capabilities in many, many parts of this extended manufacturing service world. I'll give you an example of John Deere.
Mm-hmm.
The CEO of John Deere is
the agricultural
equipment
maker. Yes,
he's the chairman of the Council on Competitiveness. I mean, their products are completely high-tech. They are smart, they're intelligent, and they have service wraps so that farmers all over the world get the weather, they know how to plant. It's a fabulous example of innovation, high-skilled jobs, export success, and leading the future for global demand in food.
Maybe there's an example right there of what it will take. Deborah Winsmith, President and CEO of the Council on Competitiveness. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I want to get to our callers. Keith in Arlington, Massachusetts. Keith, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to make the point that imports and exports balance every year. And if we want to double our exports, we will have to double our imports.
Well, they don't really balance, do they? That's why we've run a that's what running a deficit means.
You're just looking at one piece of the flow from our country to other countries. You're looking at goods and services. We also sell assets. And we sell future income in terms of debt. But the money flow, when we buy goods from China, we send them Federal Reserve notes.
Yep.
And for them to get value from those little pieces of paper, they have to turn around and buy something from us.
And so it's been assets and T-bills. So where does that take you, Keith?
Well, you could balance the federal budget, and then China would have to buy other things, and that could be goods and services, or it could be assets. But the money flows will balance every year. And so if we're going to double exports, we may very well be doubling imports as well, because the money flows have to balance, or nearly so, every year.
Keith, you're taking us right into the sort of high fiscal picture there. But Brad Jensen, what about it? How does the U.S. Fiscal balance come into the export picture if we balance our sort of federal budget? Would that indeed command an export hike?
I think that Key's point is a good one, that we sell assets as well as goods and services, and that does balance. So that's a useful point to keep in mind. The federal budget deficit is a piece of this puzzle, but if we can remember way back to the late 90s when we actually had a federal budget surplus, we were still running a large current account deficit. And it was just because investors around the world found the United States a very attractive place to invest their money. So I think that that's a strong signal about the U.S. economy.
Greg Hipp speaks.
And those big macro forces are what's driving the trade balance. I also just wanted to pick up on just quickly one point, please, about the trade balance and unemployment. You know, if we go back 2 or 3 years to 2000, or, you know, 4 years, 5 years to 2006, 2005, we were running very large current account deficits, but we had very low unemployment rates. So I don't think we should confuse the current very high levels of unemployment as being driven by the trade picture. Exports may help us get out, but it's not being driven by the trade balance.
Greg, what about the money flows between the U.S. and China and how that figures into all this? China is sitting on a mountain of U.S. debt now. What happens if U.S. exports begin to change? What is sort of a bottom line requirement in terms of Chinese policy for this export blossoming you're foreseeing to actually happen?
Well, a caller said that our exports and imports balance. That's not quite true. For quite a few years, the imports have been far higher than exports. And the difference is our trade deficit. How do you make that up? Well, just like a family that lives beyond its means, they pile up the debt on their credit card or they take out a larger mortgage.
Right. He's wrapping in the debt when he looks at that,
exactly,
but that's not very satisfying.
That's what essentially the United States has been doing. We've essentially been covering the difference by selling IOUs to the rest of the world. And that's a drag on our future income as we pay the interest off on those IOUs. And looking at the fiscal situation right now, it's very, it is a bit worrisome, because if you think of the economy as made up of households, government, and business, all of them have a spending and a saving habit. And households have started to finally save more. Corporations save quite a bit more. But so far, all of that has been offset by the big drop in government saving. That is to say, the government is borrowing so much. So in order to get the country as a whole living within its means, the federal government does have to take some important steps in narrowing its budget deficit. Not this year, because that might hurt the economy, but eventually. This, for the United States to essentially live within its means, which is another way of saying that its exports and imports have to start to balance a little bit better, then the federal government has to do its piece. And that means everybody, including taxpayers and those who consume government services, will have to tighten their belts a little bit. Tom, I wanted to touch on the point that you've been raising about whether we have to bring our wages down to China's levels to be a successful exporter. And let me just say categorically that the answer is no. There's no correlation whatsoever between your success as an exporter and whether or not you have low versus high wages. There are many countries out there that are very successful exporters, small countries like Singapore and Luxembourg, Israel, Canada, Germany, that pay extremely high wages and are very successful exporters, some of them running very large trade balances.
But tell that to the machine tool company owner in Ohio who just couldn't keep up with the wage competition from China and saw it all go away.
Well, China happens to be very successful competing in areas that are where wages happen to be a very large component of what they do. There will be other businesses formed, whether they're sort of designing skyscrapers or drilling for oil in hard-to-find areas in other countries, that will eventually employ those Americans. And I know it's a sort of a tough story to sell right now amidst 9-10% unemployment, but we know it's true because it's been true in the past. Brad and a colleague wrote a paper that showed how exports boomed from the period from the late 1980s to the early 1990s. And if you remember, back in the mid-80s, that was when the term Rust Belt first became popular and when it seemed that we would never get those jobs back. Well, what happened in that period? Perhaps I should let Brad speak for his own research, but you had two things, very important things happen. You had the rest of the world growing quickly while the U.S. grew slowly, and you had the dollar come down a lot. And those things work their magic in ways that is sometimes impossible to see happening in the here and now. Earlier on, I think the caller was asking about China's currency. I'm not a fan of protectionism, and I'm not a fan of industrial policy saying we're going to give $1 million to this company to build the brand new solar technology of the future. But if you had to look at a government policy that does help exports, holding the exchange rate down has definitely worked. It worked for China. It worked for Korea. It worked for Japan back when they were industrializing. Should the United States pursue the same policy? Well, we're a very mature economy right now, and I don't think that we have the same need, for example, to move people off farms and into factories and cities. That's long behind us. But you can pursue a policy that helps this process along. How would you do that? Well, first of all, I would encourage the federal government to take some aggressive steps over the next 5 years to reduce their deficit, and that will help narrow the excess of consumption on the government side. And then I would want the Federal Reserve on the other side to keep interest rates low to help cushion the economy as the government tightens its belt. And we know from theory and experience that when you have a combination of tighter government finances and easy Federal Reserve policy, that tends to hold the dollar down, and that does wonders for your exports.
Brad Jensen, let's say the U.S. does all that, and China still pursues its current policy. Can it, in effect, ride the brake on American exports here? Is our fate in China's hands or our own?
I think it's in our own. You know, when we think about exports, we probably aren't competing a lot with Chinese firms. American firms are probably more likely competing with Japanese or German firms. So we don't need to just fixate on just the dollar renminbi exchange rate, but also think about the dollar yen and the dollar euro. If the dollar continues to depreciate as it has, you know, kind of going into the financial crisis and is continuing to do now, I think we can expect, you know, these very productive American firms to do well internationally. You know, it's going to be, Greg was referring to some work when we looked at the 87 and 92 export boom. You know, I think that we'll see a similar pattern over the next 5 years, where increasing foreign incomes in some of our major trading partners and a falling dollar will lead to a nice export surge that helps support the U.S. economy. I mean, just going into the financial crisis, there was talk of the U.S. heading into a recession, and exports were helping mitigate that. So I think we'll see a return to that going forward.
Let's talk to somebody who's been right in the middle of of his own company's surge in exports. David Eichert joins us from Olney, Texas. He's vice president for a small aircraft manufacturing company called Air Tractor. In 1995, 90% of their sales were domestic in this country. In the last year, nearly half of their sales have been overseas. David Eichert, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
When President Obama says, let's double our exports in 5 years, from the experience of your company, does that make sense to you? Does that sound like it could add up? Could it happen?
Yes, sir. I believe it can. There's a lot of work to go into it, but I do believe that it's an attainable goal.
How do you do it? I'm looking at one of your airplanes here. It looks like it might be a crop dusting airplane or air tractor, as you call them, but it's a plane. And you've been selling a lot of them overseas. How do you do it? Why don't you get undercut by lower wage producers?
We have, first of all, we put out a very quality product. Our workers here in Olney, Texas are proud of what they produce, and we have a quality product that produces with any product throughout the world. So that's not an issue with us. We're competitive.
Do you need the U.S. government to come in and fight on trade policies on your behalf? Do you run into protected markets or disadvantages built by other countries that you need Washington to address or not?
One of the things that's been very helpful to us in our particular situation is we sell an airplane capital equipment, and a lot of the foreign markets, the financial environment in those markets are not such to permit smaller companies to access to financing to buy capital equipment with a 3 to 5 year payout.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we need the U.S. government and where we use the U.S. Export Import Bank to help provide financing to our buyers in foreign countries, and that's been a big boost to our exports.
So what's going on with your exports now, Mr. Eichert? Are they still headed up with the kind of recovery we're seeing, the markets where recovery is coming? What are your projections for the coming year?
In 2008, 45% of our new aircraft went outside the United States. In 2009, that number was 49%. I see in 2010 that it will be over 50%. So our market, we have a good market in the United States, but it's a mature market. Our growth will come outside of the United States.
Name a few countries that have been particularly good markets for you.
Brazil, Australia, the Mediterranean area, Canada, Argentina, varied countries.
That means exports. David Eichert with the Air Tractor in Olney, Texas. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Eichert.
Thank you.
Let's go to Iowa City and Stephen. Stephen, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I have two questions for your guests. Germany was mentioned, and I'm very interested in how Germany managed to be such a strong exporter with strong social safety nets and benefits programs as they have to do, because we had been thought that those are sort of antithetical to the economics of export. And so I wonder what we can learn from Germany. My mm-hmm. second question has to do with innovation in America and what the anti-science kind of regressive climate, whether the guest thinks that is holding back education in America as far as innovation goes.
That's great questions. Brad Jensen, let me come to you on the German example. I mean, everybody understands what Stephen's talking about. Famously strong social safety net there, strong wages, and huge exports. What can we learn from Germany?
Well, I think we have to look at the macro picture in Germany as well. We've talked about goods and services flows and also asset flows. I think in Germany, investors there are looking for higher returns than they can obtain in Germany. So they have been investing around the world, purchasing assets around the world. In exchange for those assets, they need to provide goods and services. So I think this macro picture, driven maybe primarily by Germany's aging workforce, you know, they have a larger, more acute aging workforce issue than the United States. I think Japan, similarly, you know, Germany and Japan look very similar in that they have very rapidly aging workforces, very high wages, very productive economies. But they have been purchasing assets around the world and thus running current account surpluses.
But both of these countries were export super powerhouses before they had aging populations. In fact, when they were young, the same populations made them into those powerhouses.
That's true. I think, you know, it's a complex picture what drives trade balances. But I think it just...
We lost Brad Jensen there. Let me get a couple more calls before we run out here. Brenda in Aiken, South Carolina. Brenda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for letting me in. Mm-hmm. Quickly, this whole discussion is aimed at a concept that violates the laws of nature. You keep pumping air into a balloon, it explodes. We have a TV show, The Biggest Loser, that shows what happens when you keep pumping food into a body. We've had the housing bubble. And the fiasco on Wall Street, that was an earthquake that produced a tsunami around the world that shows what happens when you keep the financial markets going.
Brenda, what are you saying? Exports mean consumption and the world can't afford consumption anymore?
Precisely, not endless consumption. We need to refocus the discussion from how do we achieve endless growth to how do we achieve sustainability.
Let us pick it up. Greg Ipp, what do you say to Brenda?
Well, I would say that an economy driven by bubbles would fairly describe the economy we had in the years before the crisis. I don't think it describes the economy we have now. And I would agree that when Americans were walking around with all this paper wealth because they had just flipped a condominium in Miami and they went and spent the money on a luxury car or a cruise, that was not sustainable. And that's one of the reasons why we had our crisis, because we were a country that was living beyond its means for a very long time. That's transitioning now to a country that's learning to live within its means. Now, can exports be part of that story? I think they absolutely have to be part of that story. That said, I don't want this discussion to become a little bit of a caricature where we say that exports are always good and imports are always bad. If we go back to the example of Germany, it is the world's one of the world's largest exporters, but it's also one of the world's largest importers. Now, why is that? It's because Germany's economy is highly integrated with the rest of Europe, and it happens to be that they make a lot of things that by selling to a much larger market, they can produce a wider variety of things at lower cost. And similarly, Germans don't have to make everything for themselves. They can buy things that were made in France or the United Kingdom or Sweden. And so what I would expect to happen over the next 5 to 10 years is that exports, as American exports rise, I expect imports will as well, partly because our most successful companies have far-flung operations where they're moving stuff across borders all the time. What I do expect is for exports to grow faster than imports. Back to the question of, is this good for our standard of living in the long run? I think, Tom, you've been saying, well, do we have to lower wages in order to be successful for exports? What we know is the exact opposite, is that export companies are successful companies that pay high wages. This is the way to get high wages, to be a successful exporting country.
Well, we will be watching to see what unfolds here. Really interesting today. Greg Ipp, thanks for your reporting, and thanks for your time today. Greg Ipp, U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist magazine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good to talk to you.
And our thanks as well to Brad Jensen, teaching economics at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University. Our thanks to him and our guests Deborah Wintz-Smith and David Eichert in Olney, Texas. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.